Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone's The Trail West. Narrated by Terrence Aselford, with performances by Tim Getman, Drew Kopus, Casey Platt, David Coyne, Michael John Casey, Christopher Graybill, Tim Carlin, Dylan Lynch, Richard Rowan, Thomas Keegan, Michael Glenn, Gary Tells, Bobby Aselford, Kimberly Gilbert, Scott McCormick, and Nanette Savard. The Trail West, Book One. In the year 1850, when he was but 20 years old, young Dooley Monahan found himself fallen in with bad company. It was a simple enough thing. Dooley had ridden south to a town near the Missouri border to pick up a new milk cow for his pa. She was a purebred Jersey, a rare breed at that time and place, and one which was renowned for producing rich milk. She was already paid for, and all he had to do to claim her was show proof of who he was. He was all set to do just that, with an introductory letter from his pa, enough chuck in his saddlebags to get him there and home again, and 50 cents emergency money in his pocket. He was the last born and only living offspring of Janine and David Monahan, struggling Iowa farmers who had joined the first wave of pioneers. At 20, he was already running half of the farm. He had 40 acres in corn, 20 acres in oats, 20 acres in hay, 20 acres in cattle pasture, and responsibility for all the hogs. In another year or so, he imagined he'd take over the place. He thought about all that while riding the 2 days south to Corydon, and half of another to reach his goal, the small farm town of Accord. There he bartered at length with the liveryman to trade a good morning mucking out the stalls in exchange for one night's resting place for himself and his horse. They sealed the deal with a handshake, and Dooley gave his old gelding a thorough rubdown before he grabbed his hunting rifle and the last bites of his ma's good apple pie and headed out into the dying rays of the sun to have a look around. There wasn't much to look at besides darkened windows and closed signs until he came to the mouth of an alley. Dooley was a curious lad, so he stuck his head around the corner and peered in. A packing crate, topped with a horse blanket and centered by a small mound of coins, sat back about a dozen feet from the street. Seated on boxes or nail kegs surrounding the crate were four men, each staring at a handful of cards.
Damned if you didn't deal us out a mess, Usher.
The man with his back to Dooley gave the man he called Usher a little shove. To Dooley, it all looked real friendly. At least that was what he thought then. If he had known who they were, or what they would eventually do to him, and worse, the path they would set a gangly Iowa farm boy traveling down, a path filled with pain and questions and heartbreak beyond measure, and one that would change his life forever, he wouldn't have been so eager to call out to them.
Hello there, fellers.
Hey, come on over and join us if you like.
That sounds great, thanks.
Dooley sat in on the game and they played poker until the morning light, though Dooley didn't remember it in much detail. They'd had a jug of homemade hooch they'd passed around too often for him to keep track. When he came into himself again, it was late the next morning, and they were outside town. Old Tony, the aged chestnut gelding his father had given him on his 13th birthday, was safely hitched to their picket line, and Dooley was as sick to his stomach as he'd ever been. He also began to realize he'd fallen in with dangerous men. He looked around. Usher, the one who'd been punched the night before, was a tallish fellow with oily red hair curling into his eyes and down his back. He looked quite a bit cruder than he had in the lamplight. Dexter, the one who'd punched him, was a little shorter, with close-cropped, dark brown hair and a scar running across his forehead like somebody had started to scalp him but got interrupted. Dexter looked like he'd skin his own mama for sneezing during Sunday service. Well, that wasn't right. Dexter looked to never have been to Sunday service in his life, but Dooley couldn't think of anything meaner right off the top of his head. The third man, a short blonde with a droopy mustache and a permanent scowl, was across the way, angrily and jerkily stropping a knife blade back and forth across a length of leather. His name was Grubb, a fitting name if ever Dooley had heard one. The last of the four, and the roughest, young Dooley guessed, if you took any mind to the scar on the side of his face, was another tallish fellow, his once dark hair graying already, whose name was either George Vince or Vince George. He answered to either one singly, and Dooley hadn't heard anyone call him by both names, at least not in the correct order, whatever that was. But despite his obvious lack of hygiene, Dooley could smell him clear across the camp. He seemed the happiest that Dooley was now one of them, whoever they were. Dooley was running a little shy on details. They seemed to be some kind of group, and they seemed to have plans. Later that afternoon, Dooley discovered just what their plan was, to rob the First Iowa Bank of Corydon. By the time he figured out what they were up to, he was in too deep to crawl back out. That's how Dooley Monahan came to be one of Monty's raiders, the original Monty having been lost in the mists of time, a gang of cheap rowdies who, before the Civil War, terrorized the Central Plains. Against his will, he stayed with the raiders until late the next year, when his complaining and pleas to leave and go home finally rankled the nerves of the gang to their frazzling point. One night, Vince George, which had turned out to be his name in the proper order, with the help of Red Usher and the others, took it upon himself to beat Dooley senseless and leave him for dead in a ditch near a northern Missouri field. They left him without a dime from the monies he helped them steal, or even his wallet, which still held the 50 cents that had been his father's final gift to him. All they left with him was old Tony, who at 25 was too old to do anybody any good. And they took his saddle. For 3 days, Dooley lay in the ditch, not moving, passing in and out of fuzzy consciousness, until he was found by a passerby on her way to a neighbor's. Battered and bruised and barely conscious, he was saved by a woman named Kathleen. North Dakota, fall 1869. The pot wouldn't have been considered a big one in town. In fact, it would have been laughable. But it was rich for a bunkhouse when the players were still a week and a half from payday and hurting bad for something to do. $1.14, 26 matches, an old whorehouse token, and a train-flattened nickel sat in the center of the table. Dooley Monahan held exactly two pairs, tens and deuces. Being unlucky at cards, it was the best hand he'd had in months. He dug deep into his pockets, linty with disuse, and finally dug out a dime, his last. He looked across the table at Bob Smith, a summer name if ever he'd heard one, then flipped the dime onto the table.
Call. Raise you a 5-cent nickel.
The other players had folded already and looked on eagerly, while Smith, a dull, hulking fellow with a hair-triggered temper, just glared at Dooley. Smith was the only other player left in the game, and universally disliked by the other hands.
All's I got is matches.
Everybody knew the matches would be redeemed come payday for a penny apiece.
Fine by me, Smith.
Dooley turned to the old codger sitting next to him.
You keeping track, Cookie?
Yep, that's 5 more matches for Smith. Right, Smith?
Holding a folded-up piece of paper and a crooked stick of raw lead, Cookie licked the point of the makeshift pencil. Smith tossed 5 more sulfur tips on the pile.
Call. Let's see him, Monahan.
Carefully, Monahan laid down the battered pasteboards.
Yeah, I got this one.
Smith set down his cards, but face down.
You lose, Monahan.
Smith started to rake in the pot. Cookie was 70-something, old enough or dumb enough to be brave in the face of an hombre like Smith. He grabbed Smith's arm.
Hold on there. Let's have a look-see.
Are you calling me a cheater?
Smith stood up from his chair and was bringing up his gun. Monahan pushed Cookie off to the side and drew. When it was all over, Smith lay dead, shot through the heart by Monahan, a man who normally couldn't hit the broadside of a barn with a handful of beans. And Monahan himself was shot in the left hip. It wasn't bad, just a graze, really, but it sure hurt like hell.
Smith was worthless anyhow.
Even though the rest of the men were celebrating, Monahan felt awful bad about the whole mess. He'd seen far too many deaths in his life to feel marginally good about causing yet another. A couple of weeks later, the U.S. Marshal came by, and from the men's description and the wrinkled poster he carried in his wallet, he identified Smith not as Smith, but as Jason Baylor, a man wanted in 3 states and 2 territories for everything from robbery to aggravated assault to cold-blooded murder. I make that multiple murders, not to mention cheating at cards. Marshal Tobin sat in a good chair on the boss's porch with the boss and all the hands, including the still-limping Monahan, all huddled around.
The last murder was when him and his brothers killed a couple fellers down in Colorado. Wounded 3 more besides. Bank job gone bad. If I was you, Dooley, I'd change my name and beat it out of here. Them Baylor boys is like rabid skunks. Reckon they're split up now, waiting for the heat to die down from that Colorado job. But eventually they've got a plan to meet up. And when Jason don't show...
Yeah, that's right, Dooley. They'll come looking for you sure as anything. And that Alf Baylor, he's plumb crazy.
Dev ain't exactly normal either.
Just how many brothers did the feller have, anyhow?
Just the 2, Dooley. Just the 2, but you'll feel like you're in the hands of the legions of Satan if they catch you up. They're bad business. Real bad.
Oh, crud.
He was nearly 40 and well past his prime. He'd been thinking, hoping more like, he'd outlived what little reputation he had and could get on with the peaceful business of living out the rest of his life and dying in relative obscurity. Didn't seem the dice were going to roll his way, though. Marshal Tobin scribbled on a piece of paper and handed it to Monahan.
Reward voucher. There was plenty of paper out on Jason Baylor. $500 worth.
Now that's 2 years' wages for a top cowhand.
Ooh-wee, yeah, well, the midnight, Dooley.
You can cash that in any place that has a bank and a telegraph. But I'd do it a far piece from here if I was you. Think you know why.
Monahan left the next day with a pillow under his left hip and the voucher in his pocket. 3 years later, Dooley Monahan dozed, half asleep beside his dying campfire, beneath the pewter gray of a barely dawned sky in the piney Arizona mountains. He'd been dreaming a warm dream that was 20-some years old, dreaming of Kathy, the soft quilts in that old feather bed, when he was roused by the crawling sense that somebody was staring at him. He grabbed his Colt before his eyes were all the way open. He sat bolt upright and swung the muzzle straight into the face of the intruder. It was a dog. A dog was staring at him, its mouth open in a grin and its tongue lolling. A dog with blue eyes, which he had mistaken for wolf yellow. The dog just sat there, looking at him. It appeared to be smiling at him, maybe laughing at an old man for being so dad-blame jumpy. Monahan slowly lowered his pistol.
Funny. You're a real card. Go home.
He put his gun away. The dog continued to look at him.
Well, now that you woke me up, I gotta piss.
He stood up slowly, checking the trees ringing the old beaver meadow in which he'd made camp, and found nothing out of the ordinary. At least, there was no sign of those hounds on a scent, the Baylor boys, and that was a blessing. The morning air in the mountains was still cold and crisp, which was hard on the bones of a man who had a lot more miles behind him than in front of him. Seemed like it took forever to get his old body awake anymore, since it didn't wake all at one time. Aside from the general soreness he attributed to too many years of sleeping on hard ground, they were his old wounds. His left shoulder woke first with a sharp, quick stab, fading to a dull, lingering ache, where he'd taken two Mescalero arrows about 15 or 16 years back. A man would have thought there was a tiny bullseye painted on his shirt. Those arrows were so dang close together. At least, that was what the doc had said when he was digging them out. The way Monahan figured it, that sawbones had dug out about half his shoulder joint while he was in there. At least it had felt like that was what he was doing. Son of a gun had enjoyed it, too. Monahan's shoulder had never worked all that good again, but at least it was on his left side. He would have been out of work and down to sweeping saloons and emptying spittoons if it had been on his right. His legs woke next. His right thigh complained with throbs in the places where he'd broken it, once by sailing ass over tea kettle off a raw bronc, and once by falling down a ravine when he was out after strays. Last to wake up was his head. Too many insults had left him with a permanent throb and ache. Sometimes it robbed him of all his memory, other times just parts of it. But either way, it hurt worse in the mornings. As he walked toward the trees, Monahan gave thought to his left hip. He'd never turned in the voucher from Marshal Tobin, although he still carried it in his hip pocket on the side that still ached from Jason Baylor's bullet. He figured it'd be bad luck, in more ways than one, to mess with bounty money. He'd been right, too. He'd worked all over the West since then and hadn't heard a blessed word about the Baylor boys since the shooting. Until 6 months ago, leastwise. Word reached him that Dev and Alf Baylor were looking for him. Fortunately, he heard they were looking in Utah, but recently he'd got word they were headed south into Arizona. He'd quit his job soon after and moved on, taking his cramps and his throbs and his soreness and his old hurts with him. And so, on that crisp mountain morning, while the dog watched, he took inventory of his aches and pains and waited for them to stop their hollering. At least half the time, his left foot woke up numb, and he hadn't a clue why. And his neck always had a crick in it from the time he took a bad fall off a bronc up in Wyoming. Once he'd done his business, he took another look around at the trees, just in case. Another look at the dog revealed it hadn't moved more than an inch, if that. Monahan knew dogs like that one. He'd seen them here and there on cattle spreads. Well, on a few sheep operations, too, but sheep weren't something he liked to think about, at least not before he had his coffee. Old Billy Toomey at the B-Bar T had a pair, an odd-eyed red merle and a brown-eyed black and tan, and he used them to work cows up from the range.
Stand up!
It just yawned at him and laid down, stretching itself beside the fire.
Well trained, ain't you?
The dog closed its eyes. The dog was a male and bobtailed. Probably born that way, if it was what he thought it was. Its coat was longish and rough and as wild-colored as a jar full of jawbreakers. Even in the thin early light, he could tell that much. The color was a bluish-gray broken with patches of black, like somebody had slopped watery bleach over a black dog. Additionally, it had white feet and a white chest. Bright coppery markings covered its lower legs and muzzle, and a thumbprint-sized smudge of copper hung over each eye. He'd heard dogs like this called Spanish Shepherds, or Australian Shepherds, or California or Arizona Shepherds, or whatever state or territory they happened to be in, Shepherds. The folks calling them by any one of those names got awfully touchy if somebody happened to call them by the wrong place. He played it safe and stuck with calling them plain old cow dogs. Of course, the Indians didn't call them that. They called them ghost dogs, the ones that had blue eyes, anyhow. Folks said as how Indians steered clear of those who had even one. It struck him that this particular dog must belong to somebody. It looked like somebody had been feeding it regular, anyhow. He should have thought of it before.
Where's your people? Ain't you got no people?
The dog opened his eyes and just looked at him.
Seems odd you out here by your lonesome.
Monahan's eyes flicked once again to the trees. Nothing. He was getting as spooky as an old woman. Slowly he walked through the tall, dewy meadow grass toward a pine at the edge of the clearing, pausing to pat the neck of his hobbled bay gelding, General Grant.
Good morning to you, old son.
The horse looked up from his grazing. At the pine, Monahan untied his rope from the trunk and lowered his chuck bag, which he'd stashed up the tree in case of bears. He made his way back to the fire and the cow dog, and slowly eased himself down again in his place across from the fire. He added a few twigs to the embers and gave them a stir.
Ain't heard no folks. You run off from somebody.
The dog sat up again and just looked at him. In no time, Monahan had bacon sizzling in one skillet and biscuits baking in another. The dog drooled steadily, watching his every move, but it didn't offer to snatch any from the pan.
You got decent table manners, anyhow.
Monahan started the coffee. When the biscuits were done, he broke one in two the long way, and as the steam and that good smell rose on the morning air, he poked a piece of bacon inside it and made ready to pop it in his mouth.
Wait your turn.
The dog's gaze followed that biscuit.
Oh, hell.
Monahan tossed a little sandwich arcing over the fire. The dog caught it in its mouth, chewed twice, and then swallowed. He licked his chops and stared again at Monahan.
Don't try to fool me. I know how you dogs are. Even if you just ate a whole steer, you'd still be begging for cake.
The dog stared at him expectantly across the fire, a string of drool slowly dripping from one corner of its mouth. Monahan fixed a second biscuit, then averted his eyes and ate it himself. And damned if he didn't feel guilty.
I just got enough for two more, dog.
He looked at its face more closely. The light had come up enough that he could see faint grizzle on the dog's muzzle. It was old, or at least middle-aged. Kind of like him. He figured it had to belong to somebody.
And they're little. What you weigh, anyhow? Can't be more than 50, 60 pounds. I'm three times bigger than you.
He fixed a third biscuit with bacon and ate it, at which point the dog sat straight up on its haunches and waved its front paws in the air. Reluctantly, Monahan fixed the last one and tossed it to the dog, who caught it in midair.
Happy now?
Its front feet on the ground again, the dog looked at him expectantly.
Ain't no more.
Monahan poured himself a cup of coffee. The dog shifted its weight from one foot to the other.
That's all there is. I ain't never heard anything so pitiful. Dang it anyhow. If I feed you full, will you go on home and let an old man be? Will you leave? Ah, hell's bells.
Monahan dug into his grub sack for more biscuit makings and bacon. After he'd fried up and fed the dog nearly a pound of bacon and a full pan of biscuits, good ones, whose dough had been rising all night beside the fire, and the dog showed no signs of decreasing hunger, Monahan finally threw up his hands.
You're a bottomless pit, that's what you are, dog. I believe you'd like me to fry up General Grant here and serve him on cornbread. Well, I ain't gonna waste no more victuals on you.
Then he walked down to the stream, cutting through the center of the meadow. He rubbed the skillets clean with cold, clear water and a handful of weeds, then packed up his cooking things. He moved on to General Grant, who'd been grazing. In the clear light of full morning, he brushed down and made ready to leave. The dog stood a short distance away, watching Monahan.
You can just go on home now.
Monahan gave General Grant's cinch strap a final tug and let down the stirrup. The dog's rump wiggled.
This here kitchen's closed. Me and General Grant, we got business down Phoenix way.
Actually, the business was north of Phoenix at Tom Sykes's ranch, where he hoped to find work through the summer. Monahan had been employed for the past year up near Flagstaff at the Rocking J, but when old man Jensen had up and died, his good-for-nothing son sold off all the cattle directly after spring roundup, put the land up for sale, and headed for San Francisco, right about the same time Monahan had heard about the Baylor brothers heading south. However, none of that was worth saying to the bob-tailed, biscuit- and bacon-eating cow dog.
I'm asking you again, dog. You leaving?
The dog studied him, cocking its head. Monahan stepped up on General Grant.
Suit yourself, then.
He gave the horse a nudge with his knees, and General Grant moved out across the meadow and into the trees. The dog followed. 2 hours later, Monahan was nearly out of the thinning pines when he came to an old stagecoach road. The dog had traveled quietly 20 to 30 yards off Monahan's left flank. But he raised a commotion at the precise moment Monahan reined General Grant onto the rutted road and started south. Swiftly, Monahan reined General Grant 180 degrees, certain the Baylor boys were closing in fast, but saw exactly nothing. He checked the tree line, nothing but trunks. He waited for his heart to settle back in his chest, then leaned the back of his wrist on the saddle horn. He looked down at the dog.
What? Even you live that away, go on home and quit talking about it. Quit giving people apoplexies. Go on home! I reckon you'll get a second breakfast.
The dog ran about 20 feet to the west, then turned and faced Monahan again.
Get going! Crazy fool of dog, scare me half to death like that. Go back to your folks.
He checked the road one more time, then started south again. Immediately, the dog charged to a point square in front of Monahan and stopped right in his path.
You quit that, damn beast! Just because I fed you some breakfast don't give you no call to go bossing my General Grant around. Or me, either.
The dog stood still, staring at him intently.
Listen here, Blue Dog. You're going to make me late for my business appointment. You just go on back to your folks and leave me and General Grant alone. Be a good old Blue Dog. Go on home now. Get!
At last, the dog moved grudgingly off to the side and out of his path.
There. That's a good fella. That's the idea, boy. Your people are probably missing you something fierce by now.
As he rode past, the dog suddenly jumped at the horse and snagged Monahan's reins and ripped them out of his hands. In shocked awe, Monahan saw that the dog was leading the confused General Grant off the road.
Look! Hold up, you bilious bag of bones and fangs!
Monahan leapt down from the saddle like he had a bawling calf on the end of his rope.
Of all the sneaking, scrofulous, mule-headed tricks.
He marched out in front of General Grant and snatched his rein back from the dog.
Leave! Go!
The dog came right up to Monahan, who hadn't so much as offered to pet it during their acquaintance, let alone get within arm's reach, and snagged his pants leg, tugging for all it was worth.
Hey! Stop that!
But the dog kept on yanking and nearly pulled Monahan's right leg out from under him before Monahan threw his hands into the air.
All right, for crap's sake. I ain't gonna shoot you. And you won't give me no peace till I go with you. So I'm going. You hear me? I said I'm going. So let go. Let go!
The dog let go with no warning, which caused Monahan to sit down hard and fast. He watched as the dog walked about 10 feet, then paused and looked over its shoulder, waiting.
I just better not be far. That's all I gotta say. I'm gonna dun your folks for a new pair of britches. That's what I'm gonna do.
The dog had bitten right through the cloth, leaving 4 small puncture marks. Monahan poked his pinky finger through one and out another.
Oh, dang it, anyhow. These is practically new. Only had them a year, you know, account excuse for a hound. All right. Don't get yourself in a tizzy.
Monahan climbed to his feet, brushing himself off, then stepped back up onto General Grant. The moment he started the horse moving off the road and toward the west, the dog took off at a dead run. It stopped about 50 yards out and turned, staring back through the sparse trees to make certain Monahan was following, then turned and ran again.
God dang, I ain't never seen a hound so dang single-minded, General.
Monahan pushed the gelding into an easy lope.
Ain't seen many people that mule-headed. This is them Baylor brothers. Of course, I ain't exactly seen them yet either.
As he left the trees behind and headed out through the low scrub, he kept thinking he was going to demand those folks for new britches money. And then he was going to have them tether that dad-blamed, wild-colored, blue-eyed dog to a tree until he was in the next county. But he also thought something must be awful wrong somewhere for the dog to act the way he was acting. And that surely did nag at Monahan. By the time he had covered 6 or 8 miles, and the dog showed no signs of stopping, Monahan had invented all sorts of dire reasons for the dog's behavior. Some miner owned the dog, he reasoned, and was trapped in a cave-in. Or somebody was in a gully with his leg broke. Mayhap it was some rancher's wife, stuck in a creek trying to save a spring calf from drowning. Dogs could be awful loyal. He'd heard of heroic dogs pulling children from rushing floodwaters, heard stories of dogs saving folks from house fires and such. Of course, old Two-Bits had been with him the spring he broke his leg for the second time. He tried and tried to send that dog back to the ranch to get somebody, but the old fool wouldn't leave him. Finally, they just huddled together for warmth till another hand came looking for them. It seemed like the old cow dog was more the go-for-help type, although why the dog had settled on Monahan as its provider was a mystery.
He'd thought he'd found somebody younger. Could still pull a calf out of an arroyo. Might take me longer than some, but I can still do it. But I sure ain't up to digging some feller out of a mine all by my lonesome.
Although the dog had slowed its pace somewhat, going quickly from a dead run to an extended trot, eating up the ground like nobody's business, it just kept on steadily heading someplace specific. It was single-minded, he'd give it that. Another 2 miles or so sped by under paw and hoof, and Monahan thought he'd best bring General Grant down to a walk for a while, then break out the water. He was just about to rein in the general for a well-deserved break when the dog picked up speed again and disappeared over the crest of a hill.
Oh, cripes. Well, we come this far, General. Reckon we best see what's got his knickers in such an all-fired twist.
Less than 10 seconds later, he found out. Breasting the hill, Monahan saw the dog racing along the wide flat land below and heading for a distant cluster of buildings at a flat-out run. Not much was left of the buildings. As General Grant hurried closer, Monahan could see wisps of smoke coming from what was left of the barn and a shed. They had fallen in on themselves in a black, smoky rubble. The house was only partially burnt, with a blackened hole in the roof. A dead longhorn shot full of arrows lay in the yard, and a spring calf with a spear in its side had fallen just in front of the barn. It was already beginning to bloat.
No. Damn.
Monahan slouched in the saddle and slowed the general to a walk. There was no need to hurry, no matter what the dog thought. Monahan knew he wasn't going to find anybody alive. The dog had disappeared by the time Monahan rode into the yard and dismounted.
Hello? Anybody here?
No one answered but the breeze. He ground-tied General Grant and reluctantly walked toward the corral.
Hello! No! Where'd you get to?
He found another cow, a milker, partially butchered on the other side of the barn, and a more grisly discovery out back. It was a man, or what was left of one. The rancher's face had been mutilated beyond recognition, and his private parts and fingers had been cut off. Monahan turned his head away, a surge of ancient hatred mixed with sorrow flooding his veins. Monahan hoped he'd been dead when those heathen bastards started whittling on him. He left the body where it was and started back toward the house.
Dog! Blue dog!
He followed the dog into the house. It had been ransacked. Broken crockery crunched beneath his boots, along with shards of dishes, bowls, and the pretty little things women like to set around just for show. Blue gingham curtains had been ripped from their moorings, and clothes had been scattered from their dresser drawers. Furniture was overturned and smashed. A pot of stew had burned to a solid cinder in the fireplace. Fueled by a straw mattress, fire had swept up one corner of the place and burned a hole in the roof. But it had gone no farther. Unlike the barn or the shed, the house was made of adobe and pretty near impossible to burn. In the opposite corner, the dog pawed gently at something behind an overturned easy chair. Monahan clenched and unclenched his fists for a moment. He had a good idea what the dog was fussing at, but he hated like hell to look. He'd lived west of the Mississippi for most of his grown life, almost 44 years. He'd seen more than enough of what was left after Indians came marauding. Eventually, he made his way through the rubble. A woman was hidden behind the chair. She was on the floor with her back pressed hard against the wall. There was a pistol in her hand and a an arrow deep in her breast. She hadn't been messed with, and that was a blessing, but her lifeless arm was curled about a little boy, maybe 7, maybe 8. His throat had been cut. The dog nudged the child with his nose and looked up at Monahan with a plea in his icy eyes.
I'm right sorry, feller. Hell of a thing.
Monahan knelt beside the dog and for the first time put a hand on him. Unconsciously, he began to stroke the dog's coat, comforting him the best he could.
Ain't nothing to do now, bury him, boy.
The dog turned slightly and licked Monahan's hand. After a moment, Monahan rose to find a shovel. Several hours later, Monahan stood beside the 3 mounds he had made on the far side of the corral. 2 were normal-sized, and 1 so small it broke his heart. The dog lay on top of it. He had not moved, not even to take the water in a pan Monahan had carried up from the well for him. Wearily, Monahan laid down his shovel, then took off his hat and held it over his chest.
Lord, can't rightly tell you these folks' names, but I reckon you already knew who they were. Seems to me they was good people. They had a right nice spread here anyhow, and the dog sure liked them. Ain't nothing like a dog for judging human nature, except maybe you. I sure hope you'll gather them into your arms and make them welcome on those streets of gold, and he'll take the hides off the ones what killed him so cruel. And that's all for now, I guess. Amen.
He settled his hat back on his head and addressed the graves.
Hope you folks think I done right by you. I done what I could, anyhow.
He dipped 2 fingers into his pocket and tipped out his watch. 4:00. No wonder his belly was growling, for he'd forgotten lunch entirely. He bent and retrieved the shovel, his sore back complaining, and turned toward the dog.
You hungry?
When the dog didn't move other than to twitch its ear, Monahan gave a little shrug and started for the house to scare up a butcher knife. He figured the dead steer in the yard wasn't so far gone, a man wouldn't want to eat any of it. Shame to see it go to waste. A short time later, he had a small fire going about 10 feet from the porch. He was cooking up the tenderloin he had carved from the longhorn, along with some beans and a batch of biscuits. He sat back, staring across the yard and the corral at the graves and the sorrowful dog. The poor critter had stopped whining, anyway. He'd put up a holy fuss when Monahan had carried the child's body outside, and put up a worse one when he gently lowered the little boy into the ground and started covering his blanketed form with dirt. He'd let out a weak moan when the other 2 bodies had been dragged out and buried, but that was all. After a few minutes, Monahan went into the house. It bothered him not having any markers for the graves. He figured maybe if he searched deep enough, he could find a Bible with their names in it. That, or maybe a letter or a bill would tell him who they were. He would have settled for a surname. After some scavenging, he found what was left of the Bible. It was near the mattress, and the lists of names and dates of birth and death were burned up. Back behind the wash basket, where it had likely been shoved during the fracas, he found 1 unbroken bowl. It was chipped and glazed yellow and white, and somebody, a child's hand to look at it, had laboriously printed blue on the side. He set the Bible on the window ledge and carried the dog's bowl outside with him. But he didn't see the dog. It had left the grave. Monahan's first thought was that it had swiped that big hunk of raw meat, but the meat was still on the spit right where he left it.
Blue! Blue dog! Where'd you get to, fella?
There was no sign of him. Not even a puff of dust on the horizon.
Where'd that consarned dog get to, General?
The horse just stomped a hoof lazily.
Well, I'll be jiggered.
An hour or so later, it was just starting to get dark. He was eating his beans when he heard riders coming in. His first thought was the Baylors. But he heard too many horses, and jumped to the conclusion it must be Apaches come back to get him too. He got to his feet and scurried to the shelter of the house's outer wall, pressed himself flat against it, his pistol drawn. Slowly he inched toward the far corner and peeked around it.
Creeps.
Seeing who they were, he holstered his gun and stepped out and waved an arm at the riders. There were seven of them, and as far as he could tell, none of them looked like Baylors. Not that he knew what Dev Ralph looked like. But the man in the lead, a stocky fellow riding a flashy sorrel mare, wore a badge, glinting softly in the late afternoon light. Monahan didn't reckon that a bailer, even a disgusted bailer using a summer name, would choose to ride with the law. The sheriff jogged out ahead of the others and stopped about 10 feet from Monahan, surveying the scene. He took in the burned buildings, the dead steer, and the speared calf.
Ah, hell and damnation.
Yeah, that's about the size of her.
The sheriff dismounted, and Monahan offered his hand.
Monahan. Dooley Monahan. Just passing through on my way to Phoenix.
The sheriff shook Monahan's hand while the other men in his party rode into the yard and stepped down off their horses.
Milton J. Carmichael, sheriff over at Iron Creek. We got word a raiding party skipped the reservation. Army would take 2-3 days to get here, so we lit out of town. Been to 4 other spreads already and sent the folks to town. This was the last one. I don't suppose anybody's alive.
Wish like anything I could tell you different. I buried him out past the corral.
A young man, tall and slender, stepped up and squinted at him.
Mr. Monahan?
It took him a moment to recognize a red-headed youngster as a fella he'd worked with 3 or 4 winters past, up in Utah on the Circle D. The boy had hired on about 2 days before Monahan had gone up to the line camp and had moved on before he came down in the spring.
Sweeney, was it?
Oh, yes, sir. That's me. Butch Sweeney. Oh, I thought it was you, Mr. Monahan. Sure is fine to see you again. I'm just sorry it had to be like this, if you know what I mean.
If you boys are hungry, I got plenty of victuals cooking, if you don't mind being short of beans. Took the whole tenderloin out of that longhorn over yonder. Of course, I was going to give a chunk of it to the dog.
Dog? You mean to tell me that damn dog of Morgan's lived through this?
I reckon he did. No, I'll be skinned if I know how. Leastwise, he came looking for help. Found me. Brought me 10, maybe 11 miles down out of them mountains. Dang near bulldogged my horse to get me to follow him.
Where's he now?
Don't rightly know. He was lying over there on the little tyke's grave. He's gone now.
There he is. He was just going out to round up the yearlings.
They turned to follow Sweeney's pointing finger. Sure enough, a small herd of 6 fat, half-grown shorthorn steers was headed their way at a dust-churning trot. The dog was at their heels. As they watched, the dog herded the cattle into the yard and put them in the corral. When the dog left the corral and went back to the child's grave, one of Carmichael's men closed the gate.
I'll be jiggered.
Ray Morgan told me last week how every afternoon, long about 5, Blue would go out and get them shorthorns. Didn't have to tell him or nothing, just regular clockwork. He was feeding up these 6, graining them for some fancy restaurant down to Tempe. If that pet steer of Morgan's was still fresh enough for you to butcher it out, I reckon the Apaches swarmed them late in the day. That dog would have been out after the shorthorns then. Don't know how they would have even rode in here with that old cow dog around.
Damn thing's meaner than a cornered wolverine. Should have been shot years ago.
Old Blue ain't mean, Sheriff, just picky. He was awful fond of that youngin'.
Still say he's a dangerous old cur. Ain't to be trusted. Well, I reckon we ought to get some markers made for Ray and Lizzie and little Adam. Any lumber left that ain't burned?
I reckon there's a few pieces of the barn worth using. Pulled them bales of straw out anyhow. The one blockading the corral.
Monahan, if you can get near that dog without getting bit, you'd best move it off a ways while the boys work.
It was dark before Butch Sweeney had a chance to settle beside the fire and wolf down some grub. The Hopkins brothers and Sheriff Carmichael had finished off Monahan's tenderloin between the 3 of them, but Pete Jenks had sliced off a decent cut of meat for himself and Sweeney. There was plenty to go around. It felt kind of funny, eating Ray Morgan's pet steer like that. Ray had named the old longhorn Freddy and kept him in the near pen. He was tame as a house cat. But the steer had been fat enough all right and was dead and past caring. Freddy was also tender to the tooth, having been shut in the pen for so long with no need to exercise. Sweeney ate heartily, despite his misgivings. While he ate, he watched Dooley Monahan. The man sat close enough to the others so as not to seem outright antisocial, but far enough away that he didn't have to listen to them or engage in conversation. He was older and leaner and more bent than Sweeney remembered him, but just as tough. He'd only spoken to Monahan twice, and that had been 3.5 years ago. However, he wasn't a man you could easily forget. He was a long drink of water, maybe 2 or 3 inches taller than Sweeney's 6 feet. His short, sandy hair had more gray than color. His coffee-brown eyes had a watery look to them, and the miles showed on his hands and face. Cowboying surely put extra years on a man. Monahan had been a tough old bird when they met on the Circle D. The first time Sweeney had laid eyes on him, the man had saved his life. Sweeney shoveled another bite of old Freddy into his mouth, then shook his head. Monahan didn't appear to remember pulling him out of that long-ago corral and out from under the hooves of that crazy, fresh-caught bronc that was dead set on killing him. Sweeney supposed when a man got to be Monahan's age, which was in itself a feat for any cowman, what with busted bones and the cold and the heat and the sheer cussedness of the profession, he'd probably already pulled so many idiot kids fat out of the fire that one more didn't stand out. But Sweeney remembered all right. He looked toward Monahan again. After carrying a bowl of meat to the dog, once they were finished with the markers, he'd sat down, ignoring them all and staring into the darkness. Old Blue was still out near the graves. His eyes, 2 small glowing dots of pale red in the gloom, showed every once in a while when he turned his head toward the campfire and the men. It sort of gave a man the spooks. Sweeney shuddered and turned his attention to what Sheriff Carmichael was saying.
Morgan had a brother over to New Mexico, near as I can recall. Come morning, I figured we should go out and round up what's left of Morgan's herd, push him closer to Farley Delaney's place. Delaney can watch him till I hear what the brother wants done with him.
Even though Oscar Wilkes still had a mouthful of food, that didn't stop him from talking.
What about them Apaches, boss?
Them cowards are long gone. Probably halfway to Mexico by now. We won't see no more trouble from them.
Sweeney was thinking the great Milton J. Carmichael hadn't seen any Apache trouble, large or small, in all the time he'd been in Arizona. No real trouble, just its aftermath. He was a coward, and a clever one.
What about the dog?
If I can get a rope on him, I suppose Nils will take him. He's been wanting a mean dog to chain out back of his store to keep the kids and rowdies away, ain't he? If he can't haul him back, I reckon we'll just shoot him. I got half a mind to shoot him now. Don't much like the idea of having him in town.
Sweeney rested his fork on his plate. He'd seen that dog only a few times, but he liked the critter, and it put up with him. He didn't much cotton to the notion of that old weasel Nils Gunderson keeping the dog on a short chain for the rest of his life, let alone the sheriff putting a bullet through his head.
Why not let Monahan take him? I mean, the two of them seem to get along good enough.
Sure, no skin off my butt. Be a treat to see the old man trying to convince that stupid dog to go along.
Bet you a buck you'll still end up shooting him.
Reckon I'll ride out with him too, if nobody minds.
Don't know why you rode out with us in the first place, Sweeney. Would have been a whole lot safer if you'd just kept on sweeping Gunderson's floors.
Sweeney didn't say the obvious. Nothing was safer than riding with Milton J. Carmichael. If Carmichael had been paying attention to business, instead of lollygagging at the Roberts spread for half a day, then jawing so long at the Delaney's that they'd had to bed down there for the night, they would have reached the Morgan place a day earlier, maybe sooner. They could have arrived in time to save Ray and Lizzie Morgan and their little boy. According to the telegram Carmichael had received, there were only 5 or 6 braves in that raiding party. There were 7 men in the posse, and they were heavily armed. They could have handled 6 braves who, by the look of things, hadn't owned a single rifle between them.
Fine, then.
Sweeney set his plate on the ground and stood up.
I already gave my notice to Gunderson.
You what?
Gunderson said I was even. I only came along on this shindig so you couldn't find something new I owed you for. Seems like every time I got close to even, you and Mordecai Clancy would come up with another mirror I'd broke over at his saloon.
Shut up!
Sweeney took advantage of the momentary distraction and stepped away. All he had to do was convince Monahan to let him tag along. As he left the light of the fire and made his way over to the old man sitting on his heels in the dark, Sweeney was thinking Monahan was a loner if ever he'd seen one. He hadn't said more than a handful of words to Sweeney after he pulled him out of that corral, and he'd been just as close-mouthed with the other men. Of course, the hands were full of a million Monahan stories, which he heard over and over again all that winter long when Monahan was up at the line camp and couldn't defend himself. They'd been good stories, though. A man couldn't cowboy for 20 years without becoming something of a legend, even if he wasn't aware of it himself. Monahan didn't seem to have the slightest notion he was practically famous. Sweeney stopped a few feet from the cowboy.
Mind if I pull up some ground?
Ain't my dirt.
Just as he was about to sit down, Monahan got up and ambled toward the corral. He stopped at the corral fence and looped his elbows over the top rail. Sweeney mirrored his position.
Hell of a thing what those Apaches done.
It was that. As far as I can see, nobody over there seems real upset about it.
Yeah, Carmichael's a horse's butt.
Monahan just nodded.
That's sure some kind of dog, eh?
Yep.
You best take him along with you when you go.
Monahan looked over at him for the first time.
Got no use for a dog.
Well, Sheriff Carmichael's gonna shoot him if you don't take him. He can't stand that dog. Blue bit him real good on the backside a couple years back. At least that's what they tell me. And nobody holds a grudge like old Milton J. Carmichael. I should know. I got into a saloon brawl 6 months back, and he's had me slaving at his brother-in-law's store ever since, paying off the damage. Oh, just cleared my debt. Figure I paid it about double.
Carmichael's a horse's rear end, all right. Could have told you that after I'd known him 30 seconds. That old blue dog bit him in the ass, did he? Lucky you didn't get the hydrophobics.
Carmichael?
The dog.
Monahan squinted at his hands in the moonlight, studying them.
I don't know as how he'd go along with me, even if I was to say I'd have him. Besides, folks don't like it much when a hand comes in with his own dog. Not all ranchers believe in him. I've known some fellers that would shoot a dog on sight, same as they'd shoot a coyote or a wolf.
Oh, that's sure true, Mr. Monahan. Might just as well let Carmichael use him for target practice.
You're chapping my butt, boy. Knock off that Mr. business.
Sweeney didn't say anything, but he smiled to himself. If he was any judge, Monahan would take the dog.
You mind a little company when you leave in the morning?
Sweeney wanted, like the Dickens, to ride a ways with the cantankerous old cowboy, if only in the hopes that he'd share a story or two. If he ever had any kids, he'd admire to tell them he rode a piece with Dooley Monahan, who was once upon a time the slickest hand to ever saddle a bronc or throw a loop, the man who'd shot it out with the Worth boys back in 87, and who'd known Black Jack Flannery and the James boys and Wild Bill Hickok, to name a few. He knew getting Monahan to open up just a little would be harder than pulling teeth, but he didn't mind. He had nothing else pressing to attend to. Besides, he had everything he owned in his saddlebags. He was ready to go.
You said you was going south, and that's as good a direction as any to me.
I got some fellers after me. Best stay clear.
Who are they? Are they rough customers?
Monahan turned toward him.
Dev and Alf Baylor.
Oh, I heard of them all right. I heard their brother Jason got himself killed a year or two ago. Oh, he was a mean one, all right, but not as mean as Dev or as crazy as Alf. I heard Alf shot a piano player up to Denver last year because he played the same song twice. Oh, I seen paper on him back in town. Why are they after you, anyhow?
Criminy, boy, you ask too many questions.
I'd admire to come along, anyhow. If they think they're trailing one man, they won't suspect the track of two men and a dog. Hell, we'll probably lose them all together.
Suit yourself.
Thanks. Oh, it'd suit me fine.
Monahan woke in the middle of the night to make water and found that Blue had moved. He was lying in the yard between Monahan and the others and was watching Carmichael. It didn't appear to be a real friendly watch. Whatever grudge was between the sheriff and that dog ran deep. When Monahan stood up and walked over to the pen for some privacy, the dog followed him and sat down, waiting for him to finish his business.
I'm leaving in the morning.
As he buttoned up his trousers, the dog stood and began to wiggle his furry butt a mile a minute. Monahan figured it was a good thing Blue didn't have more than a nub of a tail, or the force of its enthusiasm would have knocked down half the corral. He stooped slightly to pat the dog's head. The fur was like speckled eiderdown under his fingers. He wondered that anything could be so soft on so tough a beast. Blue pushed up against his leg.
Reckon you can come along if you like. Grab my rein like that. Danged if you don't beat all.
Monahan and Sweeney rode out at first light with Blue trailing behind, while Carmichael's men were still yawning in their blankets. They left without incident, except when they topped the hill over which Monahan had ridden the day before. The dog turned one last time and paused. After a moment, the dog turned away and followed them. All that day, they traveled south, with an occasional bob or weave in the west or east, to avoid climbing a hill too high or skidding down a gorge too steep. It seemed to Monahan the farther south they went, the faster the calendar was pushed along. Spring roundup had just finished in the mountains, and he could still feel the recent memory of snowy climbs and icy creeks chilling his old joints. But the Christmas smell of the high country had gone out of his nose entirely. The fellows around Phoenix would have finished their spring roundup a good month past. They'd get enough heat to bake a buffalo come summer, but they rarely saw more than a brief dusting of snow, and it never smelled like Christmas. He was beginning to think he'd best cowboy on the flats for a while, maybe forever. For old men with cranky old wounds, life was a good bit easier close to sea level than it was at 7,000 or 8,000 feet. A good bit warmer, too. He'd managed to push thoughts of Dev Baylor pinning him to a pine with a rusty bailing hook and Alf twisting it from his mind. Sweeney had had a point. If the Baylor boys were tracking him, and if they knew anything about him, which they probably did, they'd know he always traveled alone when he was between jobs. They wouldn't follow the prints of two men and a dog. The young man was turning out to be a halfway decent traveling companion. At least he was quiet enough after Monahan ignored four or five attempts to get a conversation going. Sweeney gave up and seemed content to ride in silence. And that was all right with Monahan, who figured he'd used up about all his talking back at the Morgan Ranch. But he wasn't deaf or stupid, as Carmichael and the others thought. He'd heard every word when they were talking around their campfire the night before. He wasn't as lackadaisical as Carmichael about those Apaches, either. He kept his ears cocked and his eyes open all day long. But the Apaches didn't show.